Welcome to the Admin Admin Podcast, episode 69, a podcast for IT professionals. Hi, I'm Al.
I'm John.
And I'm Jerry.
And in this episode, we talk about TLS certificates and viewing logs.
Applications and services to help your admining using centralized management services.
We read your feedback and suggest new podcasts to listen to.
So let's get on with the show.
Right, we're back from OBCamp.
Yay!
Much fun it was too.
It was, lots of fun.
Yeah, I really enjoyed it. Only it came for a day, but it was really, I felt it was a really chilled kind of atmosphere. It's my, was it my third or the fourth one? I can't remember. No, that was my fourth one. Yeah, and it does seem to be like just really chilled. Everyone seemed to get on with each other. It just seemed to be really, I don't know if you kind of felt the same way.
In my experience, everyone gets on with each other at OBCamp anyway, but but yeah, I know what you mean. It was a really sort of relaxing time from my point of view. Yeah, and just really nice.
So I definitely found, so as I said, because I was organising it, I found myself kind of moving around and kind of having to kind of get to places more. So I didn't get to see as many of the talks as I wanted to. Mostly just, it was due to silly things, silly little things. Like at one point somebody said, oh, the mic's not working on the main stage. And I got down there and it was because nobody had realized that there was a bar mic across the lectern. So yeah, so I was running around doing a lot of stuff like that, which was a bit annoying, but I mean, it wasn't a disaster. Definitely not. It was, just one of those little frustration things. But yeah, like you said, it very, very chilled out aside from that.
Yeah, I mean, from my point of view, being on the crew, being on the merch stand, it was my first OBCamp where I didn't go to all the talks, where I didn't sort of structure the whole thing around the talks. So it was different for me in that respect. I mean, I talked about it on our live show, but yeah, it was more about talking to people rather than listening to people talk.
Yeah.
Yeah, definitely felt more, I felt personally, I felt more accepted as going kind of thing. I mean, it's nice to actually go there and see people you haven't seen for a year. They know who you are kind of thing. For kind of a shy person, as I am kind of thing, it was quite nice to feel like that way. So, and I like the live show as well. Obviously, we'll put a link in the show notes. I really enjoyed listening to that. The one thing, kind of thing I got from what you were saying, John, is it's just finding the tool right for the job in a commercial kind of thing. If something, I really like that kind of thing, because I know Linux is really good, but sometimes a commercial product can help save you so much time kind of thing, because it does a job better than trying to do it more manually kind of thing.
Yeah, I mean, so that's definitely a key thing for me as well. But yeah, definitely we went into a lot of kind of the reasons why you'd kind of choose one solution over another. But little things like, I use Windows for my work, you know, and so all the tools that I use at work more or less don't have to be, but they tend to be focused around using something in Windows. Now, if I can choose something in Windows at work that is open source, which obviously means that we get to, you know, we could contribute upstream if we needed to, you know, those sort of things. Anyway, I'm waffling now. I'm recovering ground that I've covered already. So,
yeah, I was conscious I didn't want to go into the things that I'd already mentioned on an earlier earlier show.
Yeah, just got to say hello to all the new listeners we have. We've been watching the downloads, and they have seemed to be going up the last couple of weeks or a couple of months kind of thing. So hello from people from OBCamp if you're listening for the first time on this episode.
Hi, everyone.
The people from the Mike Tech Show. I did notice there's a couple of coming from Reddit links from the sysadmin. There's a kind of couple of posts there what's kind of saying what people should be listening to, and we're on that list.
Oh, excellent.
And there's a couple of ones from we got a link from an IT Pro Tuesday email listing where we got recommended as a podcast.
Oh, that's nice.
Wow.
We had an iTeam review from Paul, which is thank you. That was, yeah, so we've all had quite some good feedback. So welcome to all new listeners.
I should say it's our very first iTunes review, so thank you very much. And it was 5 stars, so we must be doing something right.
So, yeah, so if you are an iTunes listener, I hesitate to kind of ask you to shell for us, but, you know, that it's really nice to get good feedback from people. And to be honest with you, I mean, we genuinely love getting feedback, whether it's saying that we're the best in the world or, you know, we're absolutely rubbish. All of these things help us improve. So, you know, I mean, as a sort of side point to that, we did actually get some feedback from one listener who I'm not entirely sure. I think he was listening back right from the beginning and making his way through the archive. You poor fellow.
Or brave or clever.
Well, at least he gets to see how we're improving, which is, you know, the nice way of looking at it.
I mean, it might be better to start at the end and work towards the beginning, maybe.
A bit like that film where the guy kind of...
Memento.
Yeah.
don't give away spoilers. Nobody likes somebody who gives away spoilers.
So, we that was like from episode 38. And then, I mean, yeah, we did have bad audio back then. And we did find about... some of the things we were in the early days was trying to explain stuff, and it is really hard sometimes to explain stuff on an audio or an audio only podcast kind of thing. And one reason I set this podcast up in the first place was to kind of make my skills better of talking. So hopefully we're getting there.
The other thing as well, though, and this is kind of from my experience of working on this podcast now, is you mentioned before it's difficult to explain something in audio, but also one of the things that we tend to do, and this is kind of peering behind the curtain a little bit as well, is whilst we have kind of like a rough script of what we're going to talk about, it's very, very easy for us to hit a bump in the road and kind of start diverting down a topic we never meant to go towards. And I do get the feeling that the conversation that we're talking about here, where somebody did, they basically said that one of our episodes covered the subject not very well, and that one up from the conversations we've had kind of in the organizing channel around this, you know, I think you mentioned, Al, that it was a subject you never actually intended to cover. Yeah. It just kind of happened, so
yeah. But I think people like, I mean, it's that people like the way this podcast is, because we just randomly go on. It's like we can start talking about something and then we end up just randomly talking about something else. So yeah, talking about our Telegram group, our first kind of subject we want to talk about is one of our new kind of people who came from another, got recommended from us from another Telegram group, was about, is his name Alan, I think his name is. He's been quite active in our group since.
Yeah, I think so.
He was saying that that he was wanting some advice, wasn't it?
Yeah. So, well, it wasn't so much advice. Effectively, one of the things that people will do in our Telegram group is not necessarily rant about the things that are going wrong in their day, but they maybe might start talking about it, which is, you know, it's a natural place. We endeavour to be quite welcoming and, you know, happy to talk through issues with people. And one of the things that this guy, that Alan said was, you know, that one of the members of staff that had been working for his company, they, for whatever reason, they'd only been on the team for a short while. They'd had their accounts created on these boxes and then left rather suddenly. So, Alan was then asked to go back and deactivate all the accounts, which he said, quite rightly, is quite difficult, and is, in his words, was a chore, because he had lots and lots of different web accounts. And obviously, having had the guy recently join the team, he then was then having to go back around and go back into all the same boxes again to deactivate the accounts. And I mentioned that actually these are things that if you've got a central authentication point, then you can use that to deactivate accounts on things. So I asked whether or not he was using Windows Active Directory. And again, we've kind of talked about this in the Telegram group. So a lot of the advice that I'm giving here is the sorts of things that you'll see in the Telegram group. So if you're not already in the Telegram group, please please jump in. If you want to use Telegram, there are people that don't. Anyway, sorry. So yeah, so if you have a Windows Active Directory, was the first comment I made, but the servers you're using are mostly Linux-based, you can use a service called Radius, which originated as a dial-up authentication system. So you can then use this Radius service to authenticate your Linux machines against your Windows domain controller. And then I mentioned about how you could use Kerberos if you were... so the two systems are essentially... Radius is basically just a, is this user allowed to log into this machine? So the username is sent in the clear, but the password is always sent encrypted. And the Radius server then replies with a yes or no. Kerberos authenticates the machine with a ticket, and then there's lots of things about passing tickets around and having specific timestamps and stuff like that, whereas Radius is a kind of one-shot, am I allowed to do this? Yes, you are. And so, yeah, so I said, you know, either set up Radius or Kerberos on your Linux machines. And obviously, if you've got a Windows, mostly Windows estate, you can use Active Directory. And so I then said, you know, and then once you've disabled the account in Active Directory, it then blocks it on all of the servers downstream from there. And I did say that if, because people don't tend to tell us exactly what their day jobs entail. They might just talk about, you know, various generic things. But I did say, you know, if you were looking at databases, for example, that's a bit harder because you need to give people the database credentials so they can get in and do stuff. Or if you are writing a web application, you need to have the credentials for the database to be able to work against the database. And I said that you could use something like HashiCorp's Vault in order to abstract the secrets. So the passwords, usernames and passwords or whatever credentials away from your user to force the application to get those credentials from that service. I don't know whether you guys have used anything like any of those.
I haven't used HashiCorp Vault. I mentioned it to a guy at work and he sort of his all the colour drained from his face. I gather it's a fairly complex thing to sort of maintain. I tend to go for simpler things like storing encrypted passwords locally and accessing them when needed, or storing secrets in code in an encrypted form and stuff like that. Just because it's, as long as you can get that chain of the thing decrypted when you need it, then you're all good. But yeah, I understand, you know, the use case for Vault is, you know, it can be used for more things and more sort of dynamically and so on.
So yeah, I'm mainly from Mac Drake, but what I understand from the thing is that he was asked that when that person left, they needed to basically disable all his access from whatever server he needed to get onto. So that's why ideally you wanted to have some sort of centralized place to do it, and obviously having named accounts as well, isn't it? So he was saying that they use a system called Jump Cloud, which I'd never heard of before. I'm guessing, is that something an IaaS or something?
Yeah, effectively. So where I mentioned about using Radius or Kerberos, Jump Cloud is it's another similar system, but it's designed to be used as a single sign-on system.
Okay.
So that you sign into it once on your laptop, for example, and it then has all your authentication to Office 365 or Dropbox Sync or, you know, all those things in one piece. So when you change your password once, it goes around and touches all the rest of the systems.
Yeah. Directory as a service is what I was looking for.
Yes.
So, yeah, it's just making sure everything's got managed from a central place. And you always talk about, it's as well as just having a jump box. Or is it called a Bayesian, a Bayesian host you have? You can then dart, you basically, your first box you jump onto.
Yeah, and then a bastion from there, host.
A bastion host.
So there's actually some guidance on managing infrastructure created by, I can't remember the, it's the National Computer Security Center, NCSC. I think that's what it is. But so they are like the, an arm of GCHQ, who advise on national and critical infrastructure and the security thereof.
National Cyber Security Center.
Ah, that's what it is. I wasn't sure.
You had the right acronym.
Yeah, well, so the reason I know it is because I follow their posts on LinkedIn and Twitter. And so you always see NCSC, but you, it never kind of, I never think to actually click through and remember. Anyway, I'm waffling again. So the NCSC had some guidance on securely managing estates. And I'll have to try and dig out the link to the post that I saw now. But it recommends having what they call a browse down infrastructure rather than a browse up. So a browse down infrastructure is where you have an environment configured as your management estate. So you can only connect into the management estate to get to your assets. And then you'd browse down from that management estate. So you'd go, say, from a management terminal server or a management SSH server into your database server, your web server, and things like that. And that can, so it's typically seen as being an SSH server because a lot of the sort of originators that built environments like that would be sort of Unix and Linux system admins. But equally, I've worked on estates which are, you know, you RDP, Remote Desktop Protocol, the Microsoft desktop sharing application. You connect into an RDP server, which you can only access with specific management credentials, perhaps using, you know, a two-factor token system or something like that. So you have your management infrastructure built so that you can only ever access the administrative portals or administrative pages from that management infrastructure. The way that it was described in the article that I'd read is, you know, rather than having somebody that's got keys to every single house in a town, a central location has those keys and you have to go to that central location to get the key. It means more initial work, but it means that it's more controlled and more secure. So you know why people have got keys out and things like that.
You can also tunnel RDP over SSH quite easily. I know it's got, you can use certificates and so on with it, but I've been doing that for years, tunneling over SSH, just as an extra layer of security.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it is. So all of the my work environment stuff, particularly pre- kind of the more cloud focused stuff I've been doing recently, but all of the stuff that was on premise infrastructure stuff, you know, we would all be working remotely, but you'd connect into your work environment over a VPN, for example. But even then, that's only to get access to things like email and web systems. To get into your customer's estate, you would then connect to this central management infrastructure and then connect out from there. Two main reasons for doing that, as far as I can see, is that you only have one set of firewall rules you need to manage. So you're not having to say, oh, you know, if you're coming in through from an office site, you can go this way. And if you're coming from home, you can come this way. And you're not having to hand out loads of keys and credentials and stuff. But also it means that if you securely manage that central point, it means that if I got sacked tomorrow, they turn one point of access off, which is my account on that estate. As soon as that account's gone, I can't get to anything.
It's also auditability, isn't it? So you absolutely know who logged in and when they logged in and so on because of logging.
Mm. Although the downside to that then is that although you can see that. So if you and I are both using the same management infrastructure, the people that own the administrative, the management infrastructure know that you and I are both logged into the same terminal server, but if we're both logged into the terminal server at the same time, and two users both log into a customer's estate at the same time or within a few minutes of each other, you don't know which user that was that came from that IP, because you're all coming from a central. But yeah, I mean, there's ways of working around that. I mean, several vendors that I've at least had briefings from do have products. One of them in particular almost have like a proxy application. So if you want to SSH a switch or a router or a Linux box, you SSH to their application, and that then it initiates the onward connection. So from an auditability perspective, actually that box there is recording every keystroke that is made over that tunnel. It records every onward tunnel, so you can see all of you know who did what, exactly what they did, when they did, and like I said, it's all recorded. It's particular, the terminal stuff is all recorded, so you can see, oh, they made these requests at that point. It's quite clever.
Yeah, so yeah, we did the same thing where we have like an RDS box you dial into, you know, you can then RDS back out, but it does get a bit confusing when you start RDSing in multiple platforms. It gets a bit confusing.
just looking at the NCSC website, they've got security reviews of SaaS products as well, so software as a service. So I just happened upon the page for Jira, so they're obviously auditing these offerings, so that's a resource that I didn't know about.
Well, the other thing as well that they have on the NCSC site, and actually, you know, again, peeking behind the curtain somewhat, we have a list of topics that we want to talk about in the future. And one of the things that is staring at me is the server hardening guides. Well, actually, what the NCSC site has got is what they call end user guidance. No, I can't remember it. But basically, it's guidance on how to harden devices. And it covers all the major operating systems. So you've got Windows, Mac, Linux, Android, iOS. They're all there from how to secure a device running Windows 10 or Windows XP or, you know, Server 2012 or 2018 or whatever it is. The guidance is there on what group policy options or hardening advice there is.
End user device security collection. Yes. Put a link in the show notes, probably.
Yeah, well, I'm going to mention it because one of our things later on, there's a link to the Ubuntu LTS one. Because I was talking about it in the Telegram group, is about who is actually where you can enable automatic installation of security updates in your updates for security.
Unattended upgrades, I think.
Yeah. So you can reconfigure Ubuntu to do that. I wonder if anyone's actually done that. So
actually, yes, I do. And it's on all my servers. I must have missed that one. Sorry, I've been a bit overwhelmed recently. But yeah, so I run the unattended upgrades on all the servers that I manage at home. He says, you know, referring to the large quantity of them. They all run unattended upgrades, but all with the mandatory, all without having the automatic reboots switched on. But yeah, it works. It works really well.
Cool. I need to have a look at that, do that a couple of my servers.
I might even have an Ansible playbook that turns it on and configures it for you.
Yeah, I think cool. I've got one as well, actually.
So anything else regarding that before we move on?
No, the only other thing that I think I noticed in there was that it was actually originally talking about web accounts rather than logging into servers, which I clearly missed at the time. And in those cases, again, you really want to be using something that is doing effectively a single sign-on. And you can have applications, you can have products. Vendors call them CASB, Cloud Access Service Brokers, I think it is, which basically is a shim between something that sits between your machine and their machine, so that when you log through it, it's got all the credentials for that service. You don't ever have them yourself. But that then can reach back to your Active Directory. I'm simplifying it rather heavily because I've not actually looked at the products myself. But
again, it's just basing when you build your solution is obviously coming from experience. You want everything for a central you want everything managed from a central location, don't you?
Yes.
So that when someone needs, all you have to do is click a button or run a script what goes when. To go to doing all the work that needs to be done in the background. So if someone does leave, then it's a good task to do.
Yes. A one-click job rather than a, you know, half an hour job.
Yeah.
It's doing sort of half an hour's work ahead of time so that you don't have to do it every single time.
Yeah. It needs going, to be done. Right, where do I have to go to do? Do I have to disable this count on this domain? Whatever.
Yeah.
So what which is coming from what I've been asked to do in my job was, enabling TSL encryption between ourselves or for an email between ourselves and one of our vendors and not using plain text. For start, it's not talking about encrypted emails, like using PDP or using some sort of third-party portal. But this is like sending emails between email servers. Like, is it called MTA in Linux?
Yes, the mail transfer agent.
So when you send emails between email servers over the internet, it's normally configured to use port 25, which normally means that text is sent in clear text. You might have to help me if I get the words wrong or put me in the right direction of how to pronounce these, but it was a bit confusing when I first looked at this about a couple of months ago. Was about that. It's the first part is about that we're talking about not implicit TLS, which uses port 465, which is called SMTPS. Which MX Exchange doesn't support, but we're talking about ESMT, which is extended SMT, which is explicit TLS and uses start TLS to encrypt messages. Does that sound about right?
Yeah. So basically, both mail server, so the receiving mail server has to support this as well.
Yeah.
So this is the main problem with email is that you can't guarantee that it will be encrypted end to end unless you encrypt the content itself. But normally, you know, the sort of standard is to you strive towards encrypting everything end to end. So basically, if you encrypt your outgoing mail and you can receive incoming mail encrypted, then everything's cool. But otherwise, you may not be able to, or you might end up with a, you know, warning on the email that it hasn't been sent encrypted and so on.
Yeah. So what the thing is, the most thing I've bent far is thing called is called opportunistic TLS,
yeah,
which is basically TLS, which when you try and send the email using TLS first, it will try and send it first using TLS, and if it can't send it by TLS, it will basically send it in the clear. So this means that when an email server sends to receiving email, it basically says hello, you know, just like the hello command to the other server. The receiving email server will put in its response if it can receive emails by start TLS.
And it literally does that in plain text as well. That's quite this kind of amusing thing. You know, you can actually type these things. You can log into a mail server via Telnet and type these things in, and the mail server will basically talk back to you in English. It's fairly amusing.
Yeah, and this is how I was finding out if we were actually sending stuff with TLS or not. So so our hosted exchange, where our mail goes first before it goes to our exchange server, currently does a opportunistic TLS. But you can also configure it so that it only does TLS for certain days. It has to be mandatory TLS so that it will only resend an email via TLS and will not fail back to sending it in plain text.
So it insists on a TLS connection rather than, and if it can't, then it won't send the email at all.
Yes, correct. So that's quite good. So that's what we basically enabled on our external email. So we have to send with mandatory TLS. But the problem you've got is that obviously when you send an email, it's probably going to be bouncing through a number of MTA servers to get from one end to the other. So you need to make sure that all those servers are using TLS. You can look in the headers to check if it is using TLS. But what we found out that our Exchange server wasn't actually using TLS to send. It was using TLS to send email out, but it wasn't receiving emails on TLS because one that an Exchange covers synchronous SMTP connector, which is basically what the email receives email on, is that it that the box was ticked was doing integrated authentication, which you can't have that enabled and do that this kind of receiving with TLS. So I had to disable that. But also we hadn't selected the right certificate because one of the things it can do is that when you receive emails, it checks what the host is actually presenting as DNS name, so it can check that that certificate is correct. So, and this is not configured by default in Exchange 2010 or 2013. It's fixed in 2016. But the reason I had to do this because also with Office 365, they will, after October the 31st in this year, they will only send emails via TLS. So if your email server doesn't use TLS or can't receive TLS, you're going to be basically dropping emails from Office 365. So that's and it's just something I had never had to do, and it's just one of these things. When you set up an email, you say, "You think I'll set on port 25," but obviously the last number of years you had to kind of enable TLS. So it's just getting, if you've got any email servers out there, make sure that you can also receive TLS. And also they're going to be only supporting 1.2 TLS. And on the Exchange server I was looking at, there's actually quite a lot of work you have to do to actually get it to support TLS 1.2 and then disable 1 and 1.1 as well. So yeah, you might have to do a bit of prep work. So it's good to do the prep work before it comes October the 31st, and you find out you're not receiving emails from certain domains.
So I don't know whether you ever have to deal with mailing lists, but one of the problems that with the, you sound about the TLS stuff, there's a few other bits and pieces like DKIM that can be quite problematic. You were saying about before about, you know, not being able to receive emails from people on Office 365 after October 31st. But one of the things that I do in my spare time is I administer the lug.org.uk servers, and we have a few problems with emails coming over that from Yahoo accounts, because for some reason Yahoo have broken the way that they do DKIM, so that when you send an email with a Yahoo account, it's not handling that properly. And so a lot of the emails on a lot of the mailing lists I subscribe to, actually, where the sender is on Yahoo, their emails go straight into spam. Very frustrating. And to be fair, I don't think there's anything anyone can actually do about that, because Yahoo have broken it.
And apart from Yahoo.
Well, yeah.
How the mighty have fallen.
I remember the good old days where it was AOL.com addresses, which used to cause me headaches with receiving emails.
There's a lot of, I mean, talking about email, I was setting up SES for someone. So they decided they're running a Plesk server in AWS, just because they were having reliability issues with their sort of cloud provider that they'd found a few years ago. And to send email from an Amazon EC2 box, you have to jump through a few hoops, because obviously it's incredibly easy to automate the setup of a spam sending server. So if you want to send email out of AWS, you have to send it through SES, simple email service. But you have to do a few things to get that going. It actually, if you set it up, it does DKIM for you.
All right.
And I think you basically have to send a support ticket. You get put into a thing called the sandbox, which means you have to specify emails that can email in, so addresses that can email in and addresses that you can email out to, and you're only allowed to send those, and it's rate limited and so on. And then once you kind of proved yourself and so on, you can then move out of the sandbox and send emails, as many emails as you like, within reason. So, yeah, so it's interesting. I mean, I did a load of stuff with DKIM, SPF and all that quite a few years ago. I quite like DKIM because it's it uses public key signing to verify your emails. It's yeah. quite neat the way it works.
Clever.
Once you understand what it's doing, it's okay. And if you can automate, so you basically put the one half of the key in DNS and DNS record, and you have the other part of the key on the server, and it does clever crypto stuff to verify and that you are who you say you are, and so on. Which appeals to me. I've always liked public key cryptography in that way.
So is DKIM only outgoing, I'm guessing?
Yeah, it basically tags, it adds a header to the outgoing mail, and then the receiving mail server will check that header against the DNS record where you've got the other bit of the public-private key pair. And it does things like checks the, it takes a hash of the email content, I think, and you can then check that email's valid and so on. All kinds of clever stuff. And if you can automate the setting up of it, it's quite nice. I should also do a shout out for mail-tester.com because they will, if you send a test mail to an address that they provide you, it will tell you all sorts of things about that DKIM and SPF stuff, and also things to do with the body of the email, about whether it's likely to be received and so on. And it's got a little kind of cartoony thing depending on your score, which is obviously the deciding factor.
Awesome. So to be fair, all of the stuff that I do with blog.org.uk, that's all more or less administrated sort of by other people. So I'm just aware of it going on in the background. But no, that's quite a useful little website, that. So if you can stick that in the show notes, I will probably be consuming that myself later on. So talking of web services, one of the things that I found in my travels over the last couple of weeks is a website called TCP Dump 101, which is, so for anyone that's done operational sort of work on a, where you're trying to troubleshoot traffic going between two hosts, typically, and particularly once the network guys get involved, you'll get a question, you know, oh, can you just do a TCP dump? And it's almost like there's an XKCD about a guy trying to disarm a bomb. And it says, you know, to disarm the bomb, use the tar command.
A valid tar command, I think it is.
Yeah.
And it's like, oh, come on.
And then he goes, I'm sorry. and TCP dump's a bit of the same. One of the things that I've seen people do is they'll do a TCP dump and pipe it to grep and then not understand why CPU's just gone through the roof.
It's great if you, it's one of those things that if you get the right incantation, that you can do amazing things, but you could just flail around for ages unless you have, it sounds like a website like this.
So one of the good things about TCP dump is that you can make it render all sorts of things. So, If you're used to looking at, say, for example, HTTP requests or SMTP requests, or, you know, an FTP, sort of the FTP control structure looks like, you can run TCP dump and see all of the instructions that are going forwards and backwards without actually needing to have like a proxy in place or see the logs running.
So So we were like, again, on a Telegram, someone was talking about that they were, their Wi-Fi card or Wi-Fi was dropping off the network. And I said, well, you could use a TCP dump to actually see what the actual, what's happening on that device to see actually if it was something like the Wi-Fi dropping out or what kind of packets it was, what packets were going backwards and forwards.
So TCP dump natively won't do the Wi-Fi stuff. But if you were losing IP addresses, yeah, absolutely. You could see why, you know, DHCP requests were failing and things like that with TCP dump. But no, there are other tools that will help you diagnose Wi-Fi issues. I think Wireshark's got tools to do to look at Wi-Fi. It's definitely got things to look at, USB connectivity, but it's also, I think it's also got stuff to do with Wi-Fi, kind of like raw network sockets, and not raw network sockets. God, I'm sounding like 24 there for a second. So yeah, it's not just talking about the packets that are going over your Wi-Fi card. It's talking about how typically Wireshark would just, sorry, TCP dump and Wireshark would just be looking at what's in the, it's like your, when you're looking at the OSI model of a network stack, Wi-Fi is treated as layer one, the physical layer, even though it's not really the physical layer. Wireshark can't really look at that physical layer. You would need to have some other product that can do the, can look at the radio side of things to see why that's failing. That was a very waffly long answer there. I'm very sorry.
So TCP dump, is that basically just dumping all the traffic and then you can use something to have a look at that, like Wireshark, to have a look at it?
Is it doing packet by packet, basically, isn't it? Or frames rather than packets?
Yeah. So Wireshark and TCP dump put the, basically inject a hook in the network stack and ask that any packets that come in through that network stack get handled by TCP dump as it goes through. So on non-modified network kernels, network kernel drivers rather, you can actually see the whole interchange between devices. On when you're looking at firewalls, that can kind of bypass the network stack for certain, the kernel stack for certain packets. You might not see all the parts of the conversation. But yeah, typically on a standard Linux box or a standard Windows machine, you can see all the packets that fly across a network interface. You typically tell it to look at specific interfaces, but there's also like an any interface you can tell it to look at. So it will then capture everything that's going across the box, all your network interfaces, including the local host and things like that. And then you apply filters to what you're looking at. So a good one is, you know, if you're looking for HTTP, you can say TCP dump space minus I space ETH zero. So that's look at ETH zero space minus X to show me the contents of the packets, minus S zero to say give me the entire packet. Because ironically, zero means don't limit it. If you put one, it would only be one bit of data, one byte of data. And then port 80. And you'll then see all the HTTP traffic.
Yeah. Or you can do things like everything but SSH, because if, obviously if you're doing this while SSH is into a box, you're going to get loads of SSH traffic. And you can say, so you can tell it not to print out SSH packets or traffic on port 22.
And this website, tcpdump101.com, you can pull that information in, basically.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it generates a command for you.
So obviously, I start posting about TCP Dump 101 to a load of websites and forums. And one of those was a thing at work. One of my colleagues at work actually replied saying, TCP Dump 101, that goes quite nicely with the mnemonic of Regex 101.
Yeah.
And I've had a look at Regex 101, and actually that's a really good Regex site.
Yeah, I've used that with Logstash in the past, because Logstash is all about pulling data out of effectively, well, it's almost like TCP dump, just like packets of data, and just grabbing bits of that and turning them into different structures of data and so on. And that's where I used it, kind of in anger. But yeah, it's really good.
Yeah, so I when I was doing a lot of PHP stuff a few years back, it makes life easier to be able to do regexes. So effectively regex 101, you put your string that you're trying to match against and your string that you're trying to, the regex that you're trying to apply against that. And it will show you all the results of that. I used to use a site called Rubula, which was basically a Ruby regex engine. But this regex 101 is more generic in the regexes that it'll match against. So I think there's like three or four different regex engines that are out there, including the PHP one and the Perl one. So this kind of gave you that option. So I figured it was a good one to recommend as well.
This is a quick one as well. A certificate renewal. I had to be doing this week. I had to renew a certificate on the Windows box, and I've always had difficulty renewing a certificate on a Windows box compared to on a Linux box. And I had time this week to actually come up with a solution for Windows. When you write something like GoDaddy or 123 Reg, when you first put a certificate, you get a certificate from them the first year. You give them the output of your, you know, the signed public key, and they then sign it and send it back to you. When you then come to renew it the year later, so you get or whatever, how long you then pay your renewal fees and you say yes, I want to renew. They then send you an updated signed public key to put on your web server. Within Linux, you just basically say, right, here's the new key, and you just match it to it, and it works. But on Windows, you go, right, I'm going into the certificate and sort and then import this new key you've got, and it never matches the private key. So you have to, or in the past, what I've done is like re-sign, generate a new key, and then send it back to the CA, and then they then send you the key.
The private key is used to generate a certificate signing request. The certificate signing request is sent to the certificate authority or the provider that has the certificate authority, and they sign, and you get a certificate back.
Correct.
But on Linux, that private key will be stored in a file on the file system, and you might have it stashed away somewhere as well for safekeeping. But it sounds like the Windows certificate store, it's harder to get at that private key.
Yeah, well, it doesn't match it. That's the problem. When you get that new key back, it doesn't match it. And I found out that you can actually go into RIS, which is like Apache, but on Windows, or the web server on Windows. You can basically do that, but you can say, right, I want to renew the certificate, and you have the CA has provided me with the key, so you put the key in, but then you can't export it. It marks it as non-exportable. So if you've got that certificate on multiple servers, you're a bit stuffed. So the only way I found out, I'll put a link in the show notes, is actually you can export the certificate in a certain format and then use OpenSSL to combine the private key with the key provided by the CA, and then you can then use OpenSSL again to export it and then re-import it into Windows. So you haven't got to regenerate the key.
That's interesting. Are you on a version of Windows Server where you can use the Windows subsystem for Linux?
No, this is not yet. No, this is 2012, so no.
Interestingly, though, you can actually run OpenSSL on just natively anyway. A lot of you can get OpenSSL for Windows. In the blog post that Al's linked to, there is actually a link in there to installing OpenSSL for Windows.
Yeah. So that's what I've done. So I basically download OpenSSL onto the box, and that's what I did. And then you can export it from Windows into, I can't remember that, looking at things like a PFK file or PKA7 file or something. PFX file. Yeah. You can include the private key, and then you can run a couple of commands, and it will basically do what you do on Linux.
Yeah.
But that's really handy.
From the sounds of it, it's what it's doing. It's you're getting the private key, but it's in a format that GoDaddy and so on can't use. So it's you're taking that private key in a certain format and outputting it as a .pem file, so PEM encoded, and then GoDaddy and so on can take that, or you can generate another CSR from that.
Yeah, it's just the Windows side of thing can't cope with having that you've got that multiple certificates are sharing the same private key.
Right.
Which is annoying. So, but whenever I had to, we always had to regenerate the key to get a new CSR so they can then sign it back.
I may be wrong about this, but a best practice, I think, is to have one private key per machine. Anyway, someone could correct me on that if I'm wrong.
It depends. There's lots of different reasons why you'd have different setups for them that.
But surely you'd have to then buy a certificate for each server. Is that correct?
Well, so it's not a matter of buying certificates for every server. typically, once you've got... Well, it depends. It's a very broad statement. So certificates are just a bit. They're just data. And if you've gone with a SSL provider that charges you per certificate, typically it's because they're at the cheaper end of the market than the more expensive end. So some certificate providers will charge you per certificate. Some will charge you for registering with them in the first place. Some will charge you a cancellation fee per certificate, and so on and so forth. Ultimately, what they are doing with all of these things is charging you for the effort of creating those certificates. So if you are creating a certificate for a specific company name, you may need to pay per domain name or company name that you're creating certificates against. You wouldn't typically have to pay for a new for every certificate you mint, not unless you are being fleeced ultimately, or there's a very specific use case where you've got to use that specific TLS provider. But generally speaking, what you can do is you can generate your SSL request, your TLS certificate request, for the same set of names for every server. But then if you're talking on sort of a web scale where you might have hundreds or even thousands of machines all serving the same domain name, then that's when those sorts of things become unmanageable. Particularly if you're spinning a machine up and then destroying it again, like a few seconds later. So then you might be better off having something sitting in front of those, acting as like a reverse proxy, basically. But yeah, so there's lots of intricacies in the way you handle TLS, to be honest with you.
There's also, I was going to ask the question, but I looked it up. You can do Let's Encrypt on Windows as well. There's certain clients that can do that.
But so some companies don't want to use Let's Encrypt. So Let's Encrypt doesn't do EV certificates, for example. Let's Encrypt will only do wildcard certificates in specific contexts, and you have to do that using the DNS authentication. And to do DNS authentication, it basically means you're updating your DNS every 3 months, which is, you know, not feasible for some people, particularly when part of the selling point of Let's Encrypt is that it's hands off. When you then start having to do DNS updates, which you have to do hands on every 3 months, it's less interesting to people at that point.
And with EV certificates, you have to like prove who you are. So you have to like send faxes to people and stuff. You have to prove who you are.
Yes. Although, ironically, the only thing that an EV certificate gives you over any other type of certificate is a green box in your browser. And it has been proven that actually it's not trivial, but it's relatively easy to to be able to set up another company that's got all the same indicators of why you'd generate a certificate against that name to get certificates. So for example, I can't remember exactly which company it was, but I think it was something like Netflix.
No, I was going to mention it was Sky. It was a certificate that was basically purchased for Sky, but it was for Now TV. So you went to the Now TV website, and when you were doing secure, it said something like nowtv.sky.com. So, because obviously Sky owns Now TV, but obviously you're thinking that you don't, if you don't know that you're not, it's not, if you know that, don't know that, when you look at the bar at the top, it looks like it's nice green EV.
No, it's not that story at all, actually. There was a guy in the States who wanted to prove how pointless EV certificates were. So he registered something like, and I can't remember specifically which name it was, but it was something like Netflix, a company of Massachusetts or something. It's probably not Netflix, but say, for example, it was Netflix. Netflix of Massachusetts versus the proper Netflix, which is of Silicon Valley. So he'd registered in another state a company called Netflix as a trading name for himself.
Mm-hmm.
So he paid like the $50 or whatever it was to register the company name there, and then went to get a certificate for his company name, which was Netflix of Massachusetts, and then created the domain, you know, netflix.something.com. So his EV certificates is Netflix, but it wasn't Netflix's domain. So then you're talking about phishing attacks, which are dead simple to...
Certificates do feel like an imperfect solution sometimes.
Well, they are. Essentially, the downside to my job is that I tend to read a lot of mailing lists and websites about cryptography and security. And just recently on the cryptography, one of the cryptography mailing lists, there was one of the guys that was involved in the original conversation about SSL certificates and the PKI infrastructure that went around it. So that's the public key infrastructure. And essentially what PKI was set up for was to allow people to do online shopping without having everyone see credit card transactions. They were never really designed to, they weren't designed to provide the level of protection and privacy that we've kind of bolted on, much like the conversation earlier about email. You know, all of these things were created predominantly at a time when you didn't really need to worry about malicious people on the internet.
Because the internet was just between a few universities in America.
But then later it was between, you know, a few hundred thousand people and a few companies. It wasn't, you know, a few million companies and a few billion people. So, yeah, I mean, it's sad. And people tend to vilify PKI and say it's dreadful. It's a badly architected solution, all that sort of thing. If you take it in the context of what it is, which is a way of opportunistically, I'll get that right in a minute. Opportunistically, yeah. Encryption between, you know, my machine and your machine. Without having to have trust on first use, which everyone would just trust everything, and without having to worry about what happens when a certificate needs to change or when you've got more than one web server, so therefore you don't want to have the same certificate on two machines. PKI gives you a way of working around that that isn't hugely intrusive. And whilst it may not be perfect, it provides generally good enough security. The problem is that people attach too much to the fact that there's a padlock there. And they think that means it's secure against everything. They think that it means their credit card's secure. They think it means that company's been vetted. And actually, it means none of those things. It just means that you own, or somebody owns, a server that's got that domain name, and that's all it means.
And well, and that your traffic is encrypted to that server, right?
True. So, I mean, it's a difficult one, frankly. So let's move on, because this turned into a much larger topic than it was intended to be.
It's getting kind of depressing.
Well, let's talk about some good news then. Al?
Yeah, there's a command I learned the other day, which kind of segues into another part of our topic, is LNAV.
LNAV.
LNAV, which is really good. I've used it a couple of times since finding about it, and I've told about it a couple of people. I go, wow, this is cool. It's a tool you can install on Linux, and it basically you run the command and you point at a log file or a folder, and it will basically look at all those log files in that folder, and it will basically color code the text for you, and you can go up and down to look at the code. I think you can even search and stuff, but I haven't got that far yet. But it's really cool. Have you tried using it?
Yeah, I was listening. Well, I heard it on the Binary Times podcast, which I think we'll mention in a minute. And I was actually on the train. I had my laptop in front of me, so I installed it and used it there and then. And yeah, it's brilliant. I think I had heard about it before, and I was like, oh yeah, I must try that when I'm at a computer. But this time I actually was, and yeah, it's brilliant. It's an NCurses interface, so it's just like a sort of terminal text interface. Use the cursor keys to move around and various shortcut keys. A bit like something like Top or something like that. But yeah, great for viewing log files and searching through them and so on. And you can do things like pretty print the log files. So if you've got a long line of text, it will do things like break it up into almost like a paragraph and so on, make it much easier to read. So it's a lot more lightweight than something like Logstash, Elastic, you know, an Elk stack or a sort of external software as a service type thing. Yeah, it's really nice. So one thing I did notice, it doesn't seem to be available for CentOS 6, which would be really handy for me. So if the developers are listening, you know, make it work on CentOS 6, that'd be great. It seems to be something to do with the C++ compiler.
Hasn't CentOS 6 been like end of life for a while?
Unfortunately, I think it's still going to be alive until about 2020.
Right.
Yes, that's good, because I haven't got me my mail server until then.
Fair enough. So my problem, fundamentally, I haven't got a problem with the script as it stands, and I would probably have a good look at it. My only real concern, actually, is that I don't actually tend to be looking at logs that closely. Typically, if I'm looking at logs, it tends to be because I need to see something happening there and then. So I'll tend to be doing a tail minus F minus N zero.
It does, but it does it when it auto refreshes.
So if I need to look at something right then, I know more or less what I'm looking for at that moment. So I can look specifically at either the file that I'm looking for or everything in varlog. But also most of the boxes that I'm looking at, are vendor supplied images. They're not boxes that I can just add random packages to. So I then can't look through the logs.
You could centralize your logs if it's possible to send something to a syslog server and just have it all aggregated there. You could probably do something like that.
Yeah, possibly. Possibly.
But for me, as a person who doesn't look at logs very often, I only have a couple of servers I look after, it's really handy.
Mm. Oh, absolutely. As I said, I haven't got a problem with it per se. It's just I don't think I'd have use for it myself.
Yeah, I mean, for my use case, it's I'm looking at having to set up a Elk stack, which is a lot of work for probably not that much reward. But yeah, I just wish I could install it on CentOS 6. Maybe I've got to do a, you know, centralized server thing like I just mentioned.
So that kind of segues into my next section, which is our final section, is there's about 5 new podcasts I've started listening to in the last month kind of thing. So, and the reason I found out is it was from the Binary Times. which obviously you've mentioned before, actually, Jerry, and I actually managed to come across them by mistake because I was looking for the Linux Lads podcast from who we met at Ogcamp, who released a podcast called Linux Lads. It was three Linux guys from Ireland, and I couldn't remember what it was called. So I was just Googling Linux Ireland podcast, and that's and the Binary Times podcast came up. So I thought I'll give them a listen, and then yeah, and it's quite and that's how I found about that that command. So that's one podcast. The Linux Lads podcast is really good. Just a bit like I said, kind of just start on one and then go off on a tangent.
I should say as well that I went out on the Saturday night with the Dublin Lug guys who are basically Linux Lads. We ended up in a rock bar late Saturday night. So yeah, that was fun.
Because obviously when you went at the last previous old camp, we were talking to them. Yeah, so we just, that's what we talked about. Yeah. So yeah, the next one is the bugreport.co.uk, which is the people, the old Linux voice guys.
So it was Linux format. And then it became Linux for then it for a very brief while was the Linux. Oh God, I can't remember what it was called now. But like there was one episode where it was just after they'd left Linux format, but before they'd started Linux Voice, and then it was Linux Voice, and then they've obviously handed off the control of Linux Voice to another organisation. Linux Magazine, I think it is. So they now don't own the name Linux Voice anymore. So, and also, Ben's moved off to do, a different magazine. I don't know whether you guys noticed, but, Graham, who's one of the guys there, he's gone on to, also host on Late Night Linux as well.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, he's all over my feed these days, that guy. Not quite as everywhere as Alan Pope and Martin Wimpress, but you know, still.
Well, not as much as Jay Reddington.
I was most surprised to hear Martin Wimpress on TechSnap there this morning. It was quite a surprise. Makes it quite into quite a different show, I thought.
Yeah, definitely. So the other one we talk about is another one. It's called the Ubuntu Security Podcast, which is a weekly podcast which basically just tells you the latest security patches Ubuntu have released, which is quite informative, really. So, yeah, take that out, because that's where I found about the link about the securing the Ubuntu box. So check that out. And the last one is Unattested, which is Dan Lynch and Kaz, which is not really anything to do about Linux or open source, but it's always nice to hear Dan Lynch's voice.
It's called Tales of the Unattested. It's kind of a sort of users send in emails and then they discuss the emails and sort of go off on tangents, which is it's quite interesting. I found the first couple of episodes quite interesting.
I've also noticed that Dan seems to have just started up another podcast with Fabian Scherschel, who's the guy that he did Linux Outlaws with. But it's not about Linux. Once again, not about Linux. It's about they're watching TV series together, sort of in their own homes, and then talking about them as they watch through them. So
Hollywood Outlaws.
Yes,
because I saw a thing on the Twitter with it, and I went Someone's taken the mick out of Outlaws, and then a couple of days later, they actually had it was actually real that they're at. And I mean, and I really miss Linux Outlaws because that's kind of my first kind of Linuxy podcast because I really got into. And then that was only about 10 shows before they shut it down, so I was really annoyed about that. So yeah, check them out. Be linked in the show notes. Yeah, and also any new listeners, yeah, if we'd like to hear from you, just drop us a line. Just it's nice to hear that. What you're thinking, if you're enjoying it, send us an email at mail@abnabnpodcast.co.uk or join us on our Telegram group, which is growing day by day kind of thing. We have a nice little chat in there. So, yeah, get in touch.
It's really good to see everyone and get the feedback, and we read every bit of your feedback as they say, and we really love hearing what you think of us. whether it's good or bad or indifferent, or hopefully not indifferent, but you know, any feedback is good.
And again, mentioning from before about the iTunes feedback, iTunes reviews rather, they obviously help people to decide whether or not they're going to listen to a podcast. So if you do listen to this podcast and you're listening to it on iTunes, please do review our show. Ideally with 5 stars, but you know, not everyone thinks we're perfect. You know, only my mum, maybe your 2 mums. I'm not sure.
My mum doesn't actually listen to the podcast.
Dreadful.
Yeah, my wife says it sends us to sleep. It's using the kids to go to sleep with. So, yeah, we try.
Interesting story. Whilst my wife was pregnant with my eldest, she used to struggle with getting to sleep. So, probably about sort of once every 2 or 3 weeks, all I'd get is, John, tell me about Linux.
Yeah.
Well, one last thing to mention. We mentioned this quite a few episodes ago, and I was just reminded of it a few days ago. We have a Patreon account, so I hope you don't mind us asking you for lovely money, but if you wish to donate to the show, that's an avenue of doing it. At the moment, I think you get rewards for certain levels of donations. At the moment, we have one Patreon, and that's producer Dave. Hi, Dave. He's our only Patreon. And I've actually, when I set it up, I said that if you donate at this level, we'll read your name out on the show. So we've ended up reading out Dave's name on the show because he produces our podcast by pure coincidence. So if you want your name read out on the show, please give us some money.
Yeah. Remember just saying, yeah, thanking Dave there and for Joe Resident for doing the audio on our last podcast. So
yeah. He was an absolute trooper. I mean, not only so normally we hand these files over to Dave, and Dave works his magic on them. And Joe, so I think between us recording it and putting it out on the feed, I think it was only like a day or something. Mm. And that was bearing in mind Joe not only recorded the joint Ogcamp recording, he also did I think a late night Linux.
Yeah.
And a Linux Unplugged. Yeah. No, not Linux Unplugged.
TechSnap, was it?
I can't remember which one it is, but he did one of them.
He edits TechSnap as well, which I didn't know. I found that out at Ogcamp.
Don't tell anyone his secrets.
Oh, sorry. You might have to cut that bit out.
No.
I was wondering why it was sounding so great.
But yeah, so he's a busy man, and he was an absolute trooper for that. So thank you very, very much.
He was recovering from a hangover as well when we did the actual recording. So
yeah, I think pretty much Joe only comes to our camp for the drinking in the evening and for the live shows. That's all he's there for. Yeah.
He whipped out. We said we wanted to record that show, the live show, and he whipped out a mixer from his rucksack and four microphones. So it's like a mobile recording studio.
So I think that's another admin podcast in the can. So thank you very much, dear listener, for listening, and please feel free to have a look on our website for ways to get in touch with us, back our Patreon account, and we look forward to hearing from you very soon.
Bye for now.
Bye.
See you later.